Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 21st, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks. On a Michael Friday, this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industry-ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Digby, the great political analyst, blogger, historically informed commentator. She talks with Sam about the week's news in an interview that was recorded just yesterday, contextualizing everything. And then the great, the astute, the shrewd Michael regular Corey Pine joins us to talk about Michael Bloomberg and Hillary Clinton and other of those types of people. Jamie's already giddy in anticipation for this roast fest that's coming. We'll also give a movie pick. Donald Trump unloads his venom and grotesqueness on Christine Blasey. And, of course, does it through a Twitter and a fascist campaign rally. More Americans oppose the Kavanaugh nomination than support it, which is nice sign. I don't know how much of an impact it will have on Republicans, but a positive sign for the country. ICE arrests undocumented immigrants who came forward to take undocumented children. That's nice. Ben Carson's political HUD, political loyalty required. No experience necessary. Jordan Peterson threatened to sue a critic for calling him a misogynist. I remember being told of this story before it broke.
Free speech, baby.
Jordan, I'm going to call you a lot of things in this book I'm working on. Would appreciate the pub.
You've been served.
White House authorizes offensive cyber operations to deter foreign adversaries. Private tax collection raising much less than expected. What a surprise. And the U.S. maternal death rate is amongst the highest in the developed world. 18 states have not studied these deaths. And others tend to place the blame, of course, where it should clearly belong. The moms. Black children are 18 times more likely than to be tried as adults than white children. And the real question is, why are we trying any children as adults? An internal poll suggests that the GOP has lost the message battle on taxes, and Noam Chomsky visits Lula da Silva in prison in Curitiba in Brazil and says it's a great feeling to meet one of the most important figures in the 21st century as his stand-in continues to rise in the polls. All that and more on today's Majority Report. I, of course, am here along with super producer Matt Leck, on loan from TMBS, and super contributor slash writer slash video monitor slash what's the fourth one we should put?
Ultra left polemicist
Jamie Peck.
Hey,
Brendan is on the move today,
but he did help produce the show.
He's a very great producer. You show up and everything is laid out for you, ready to go. We're all just like automatons here. We don't even need to think.
Big ups to Brendan.
The content is Brendan. I maybe am just too drained. I watch this because we like to run clips before we play them. I know that this guy is being an asshole, but I don't exactly know exactly the ways in the target of it or the ways in which he's doing this. I don't know whether he's making an age joke. He's certainly obviously dismissing the story about Brett Kavanaugh. It's a little confusing, but this is Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina. And he was speaking yesterday at an event at a, looks like a Kiwanis club. And he had this to say about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
I'm just to be here. Thank you for coming out. I thought I was going to be late. Did y'all hear the latest late-breaking news from the Kavanaugh hearings? Yeah. Ruth Bader Ginsburg came out that she was groped by Abraham Lincoln. I thought I was going to have to be back. Much less honor me to be here.
Fire. Guys should come become a joke writer for the show. I mean,
hey, you can get away with a lot if you're funny.
That's true. So Ralph Northam can't get away with anything.
Patreon.com/Ralph Northam.
Norman, excuse me. Ralph Norman. No, you spelled it right. I'm just is Northam's the Democratic governor of Virginia, I think, that I'm messing his name up with. But yeah, I mean, what I love though is that like with these like date references, it's like that's not the we've said a million times if someone like Brett Kavanaugh came out and said, this happened 35 years ago. Horrific event. I own it. Maybe it's even actually informed my views on juvenile policy, which it obviously hasn't, and restorative justice in general, which it obviously hasn't. We're talking about a completely different situation. What we're talking about is that today, it's what did Nixon say? It's the lie. It's the cover up. Seldom is the event. Like, it's that. It's the lie and the cover-up.
Alger Hiss, yeah. That's what got Nixon.
It depends what the event was, but...
Well, of course.
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, that joke is dumb because, like, it barely even makes sense, right? Abe Lincoln is not nominated to the Supreme Court. It's also...
Yeah.
It's also, like, he's able to shoehorn in multiple kinds of misogyny into one joke, right? Because it's, like, making fun of... survivors at the same time that it's like ragging on a woman for her age. So in a way that's very impressive.
Well, it was also impressive all the ways in which it wasn't funny.
That's the thing, is it says nothing. What the message of that joke is that this is a laughing matter, which is
yeah,
that's why he told
right.
it, right?
Like he's that's it.
He's preparing the room to move beyond that and not be like, oh well, we got this serious thing. It's like, well, we got this. Let's introduce some levity here because that's what's going to make it more comfortable for me to be here with you.
Yep. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. That actually is almost, that sounds like maybe current Dennis Miller material.
That does sound like
turns out
material.
Then Ruth Bader Ginsburg with Abraham Lincoln. Bop, bop, bop.
That's all that was missing.
Yeah, if he did. It was a bop, 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 bop. All right, it's great to be here.
See, then it would have been
Fran
funny.
Brought some pot roast for us, and it's like gerbils on the Hindenburg. Am I right?
Mary Todd is requesting an investigation by the Pinkertons.
By the Pinkertons. The Pinkerton Company.
But they're the deep state.
They're the deep... No, they would like the Pinkertons. I think they would like the Pinkertons, these guys. The Pinkertons are a major party of the Republican brand. If you like stories you hear on this show, we think you'll like the Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust is out now, bringing your storylines from across the Western U.S., Season 2 of The Land I Trust is out now, bringing you storytellers from across the Western U.S. who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, and living with the four natural elements, water, fire, wind, and air. The series has 14 tales of individuals across the western part of the state, as they share their tales of climate change, clean energy, and everything in between. Each year, the Sierra Club visits a different region of the country for a new set of stories. Season 1, Stories from the American South, talk to musicians, families, farmers, and climate refugees, helping to move the South from a coal ash pollution to a brighter, cleaner future. You can listen to The Land I Trust. You can listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories or at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Season 2 of The Land I Trust today. We're going to go to this interview. It's about 45, 44 minutes or so with Digby that Sam recorded yesterday. And then we will be back with Corey Pine.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? You ready? ready for some Digby, 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 yeah. And a bit of hullabaloo, a bit of hullabaloo should do ya. How about some hullabaloo? Just rub it on ya. It's so good for ya. Digby.
Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to have on the program the proprietor of the Uber blog, Hullabaloo, and the writer from Salon.com, Heather Parton or Digby. Hi, Heather. How are you?
Hey, Sam. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well. Now, we're recording this Thursday evening. We're going to play it on Friday. So who knows what could happen between now and then. But there's so much to talk about this week that it's a little bit hard to absorb. Of course, the big story is the Kavanaugh nomination. I think if we had spoken, well, maybe not this time last week, but pretty close, like right, a week from Wednesday or something, it was basically all she wrote, and then. Ryan Grimm had a piece in The Intercept about a letter that had come to Dianne Feinstein in July from a woman who alleges that she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were both teenagers. In the room was this other guy, Mark Judge, who was a writer who has written such great hits like... I gave up my liberal guilt when I projected that a black person stole my bike was one of his pieces on top of a memoir about being completely blackout drunk during high school. This woman subsequently said that she would testify. Where we are today on Thursday, I think most people know Thursday night. She is in negotiations with members of the committee, apparently, to testify. What I mean is that what your understanding of what the latest is as of Thursday evening?
That's my understanding, that they're still in negotiations, that she is saying she's willing to testify under certain conditions, including her safety, which I think is reasonable, considering that apparently she's really been threatened quite seriously and had to move out of her house. And that, so now, as at this moment, and perhaps when this airs, we will know something more. We don't know yet whether or not they're going to agree to extend this artificial, completely arbitrary deadline they put up of Monday for a couple of days so this woman can, secure her safety. We don't know whether or not they're going to do that. It would be absurd and, frankly, obscene if they don't.
Right.
This deadline is meaningless. It has absolutely – they made it up out of whole cloth. It's ridiculous. And, in fact, the whole rush on this is completely – made up out of whole cloth. And it's one of the things that I think really sort of exposes what they're doing here in a way that I can't imagine is really going to work for them. I mean, the desperation that they have to get this particular right-wing nut on the court immediately is bizarre to me because, they're going to, it's highly likely, 99% likely that they are going to get some right-wing nut on the court, right? I mean, he's president, unless something really astonishing happens. Donald Trump is going to fill the seat, and it's going to be filled with a right-wing nut. Why they are going to this length to put this particular right-wing nut on the court is the big question in my mind at the moment.
I mean, that is a fascinating question, right? I mean, because, I mean, look, I can understand why they wanted to do this within a week, because they don't want other women to show up. They want to not give this woman, look, all the worst of it is coming this week, right? Like, the death threats are going to start 15 minutes after people know her name. The most vulnerable she is to the limelight would be this week, right? It seems to me. And any other notion, if they give up this ghost that, like, we have to do this now, and there's notion that you can actually investigate this, I think that they must realize it's problematic for them, right? Like, because they, look, they anticipated, we didn't see with Neil Gorsuch, let's put it this way. We didn't see Neil Gorsuch, people coming out saying he's great in a carpool, and maybe he isn't. Maybe Brett Kavanaugh is. But even still, there was no attempt to sort of say this guy's good for women in any way, or that he's nice to his women. Like, there was a particular strain, I'd say, to or flavor to the Brett Kavanaugh promotion tour that took place prior to this, right? It was all sort of geared towards, like, he's a nice guy. He's good with women.
You're so right. You know, it's so interesting because looking back on this now, just over the last month or so, and in particular the last couple of weeks, in light of this, and I hadn't thought of this until you just brought this up. I mean, we did see, you know, they brought out the girls' basketball team and he's a great soccer dad and all this. But there's been an ad that's run on a loop on my cable. I don't know if it has on everybody else's. And it's this friend of his. She's not a legal expert, or she's just some woman who knows him. Very nice looking woman, you know, obviously somewhere around his age. And she goes, I've known Brett Kavanaugh for 35 years. And I just felt like I just had to say what a great, wonderful person he is. He's just a terrific guy. And I thought, even as I watched it the first time, I'm going, what is, you know, that, I don't get this. I mean, you know, it's, why do they feel such a need to come out and show that he's a, to have women testify to how nice he is? And that's not just about abortion rights, right? I mean, it can't be, because we, you know, he's
odd.
Good.
It's, I mean,
it's odd.
It seems odd. Like, they were anticipating there's a problem here. Now, they may have anticipated this accusation in some way. Or maybe they were anticipating other accusations. I mean, maybe they were anticipating having more of a problem with Brett Kavanaugh's relationship with Kaczynski. I mean, that seems conceivable to me. The Democrats didn't seem to make as much of it as one would have thought. Mazie Hirono did, senator from Hawaii. But beyond that, there was no one else who really sort of, like, went at him about this. But it is very interesting. And so one gets the sense that this week is a function of, because, I mean, look, if they're worried, right, on some level about just sort of, let's say it's the generic abortion thing, okay? If they're, that would mean they're worried about suburban women, Republican women, right, in depressing their turnout. But if that's the case, then why not wait till after the election? Like, you know, because no one they're going to put up there is going to be a, no one's going to get up there and say, I gotta say, this candidate, he is a champion for women's rights, right? Like, he really, like, there's no one they're going to nominate who's going to be anything other than an obscure a person whose desire to strip women of the sovereignty of their own body is obscured in some way. And so it you know, maybe they don't want to do this in the lame duck because they think the Democrats are going to win the Senate. Maybe, but I can't imagine. It's almost unimaginable to me that there's a scenario where Mitch McConnell is like, you know what? That's a bridge too far. I'm going to seem like a real hypocrite if we if we try and, you know, push through a nomination during the lame duck. I mean, that's not possible. And so this is really fascinating that they wanted to raise, this happened so quickly. I think the idea is that they want to convince her not to testify, right? Like, not even because I may be wrong about this, but I'm trying to imagine a scenario where she testifies and maybe the Republican senators can all walk away and say, like, not compelling enough to vote against him. We can't damage his whole life because of, of these just one charges from this woman. But that's, I would imagine, that's not too good of a look for a party that has a narrative built around it being misogynist to regardless of how she, so-called, I'm putting this in quotes, performs in testifying. It really is bizarre.
It's very bizarre. And it's, even people like Rob Stouthart from the New York Times, who is, he's a very, far-right conservative who very, very much, anti-choice. And even he has sort of pointed out that, put this kind of guy, this sort of, defending this guy under these circumstances kind of lends credibility to the idea that the anti-choice position, or in his words, the pro-life position, isn't really about fetuses. It looks more like it's about women. The rest of us are out here going, you just noticed that, did you? But this is a big problem, because even Republican women, who maybe they're even pro-life, they are absolutely bleeding from the Republican Party because of their loathing for Donald Trump and this kind of stuff. This just, it's never ending. This guy has just sort of introduced this open, blatant disrespect, disregard, outright misogynistic attitude and saying, hey, bring it. What are you going to do about it, ladies? That seems to be kind of the attitude here. And so you've got Kavanaugh here. It was a perfect opportunity for these Republicans to refuted by absolutely coming and saying, look, we love Brett. He's a good guy. He's been a great guy. But you know what? Under these circumstances in the Me Too era and all this, I'm sorry, we're going to respectfully ask that Brett withdraw his nomination and we're going to bring somebody else on. And if they were smart, they'd bring on a woman, right? I mean, right. That would be the obvious choice. And that would absolutely be seen as some sort of reassurance to all these Republican women who are running as fast as they can from the Republican Party to say, look, don't worry. We get it. This guy is the president is a pig, but we're seeing the light here and we're not, it's not going to be that bad. Go ahead, stick with us here. I mean, I don't know what else they can do, and yet they're not doing it. So this is not going to help them with their problem, which is a huge electoral problem. Republicans cannot win without white conservative women. They just can't. They are screwed. That they have to have those votes because they get no people of color. They get right. no obviously no liberals. I mean, they just, a lot of college educated white men are falling out as well. They've got a big problem, and this kind of blatant just sort of, hey, what are you going to do about it? It's really surprising to me. I mean, I would have thought, and I think Mitch McConnell knew this, because I think he was the one who did not want them to put up somebody like Kavanaugh. And Kavanaugh specifically, he argued against it, because there are plenty of them who don't have his kind of paper trail, and they're just kind of boring white guys like Gorsuch, right? And, the Republican, if it was about abortion, you make a good point. The Democrats could have made a big deal about Gorsuch, but it was not the same thing. There's that, Kavanaugh, and, we've talked about this before, you and I have, about, what a hardcore Republican operative he is. To choose him and to pick this fight, it just seems really bizarre to me that they are so far in the Trump tank. I mean, you have guys like Dean Heller, who's got a real race on his hand in Nevada, going, well, this is a little hiccup. You think Nevada women, are Republican women, think that this is a hiccup? I don't think they do.
Yeah, it is mystifying, but you know, there's also an argument that, you know, before people interpret this as saying, like, it would be a good thing for you know, for the Republicans to confirm Brett Kavanaugh in light of this. And even if Dr. Ford testifies, you know, from a political standpoint, it would be a good thing. I am of the mind that you delay. You delay when you don't have the power. You kick the can as far down the road as you can and hope something turns in your favor. I mean, that's what happened in this case, right? And and one doesn't know. Maybe the Democrats take control of the Senate in, you know, and during the lame duck, maybe, I don't know. Everyone gets hit with the flu and they can't vote. I mean, who knows, right? I mean, so you keep the door open as long as you can. So I, you know, still count me as someone who is hoping that Brett Kavanaugh is not confirmed, and that, you know,
it is, you know, it absolutely. I mean, I hope no one is interpreting my words as saying, "Gee, it'd be really good for us if he gets." It's not good for us. It's horrible for. You know, Democrats, it's horrible for humans, for
frankly,
Brett Kavanaugh to be
It's
to
horrible
be
for people who have not been born yet. I mean, because what we're
exactly.
talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's an awful thing. And the Democrats are in a terrible position here because regardless, you know, there's no upside. Let's just put it this way. There's no upside to this. From the moment that Donald Trump was elected illegitimately, we knew that this was a possibility. We knew that we had one seat open, and then, you know, who knew which, you know, whether Anthony Kennedy was going to last, and he proved that he wouldn't. So this was always a possibility, and it's a horrible situation. And by the way, let's not pretend that, you know, if the Democrats are able to somehow stop this Kavanaugh nomination, that means that the next person they put up isn't going to be just as bad
or worse.
On every other level, or worse. So it's hard to imagine anybody's worse than Kavanaugh, but, you know, it certainly is bad or worse than Clarence Thomas or anybody else on the court. That is just the nature of this. We've seen, you know, they've got the list, they're checking it twice, and McConnell is very much involved in this. They will try to put the most, you know, the most right-wing justice they can put on the court, and that is very, very, very right-wing. There's no upside for Democrats. Either way, and not even electorally, because, by the way, I think Democratic women are absolutely, they are as energized and electrified as they can get. This is just frosting on the cake. Democrats don't have any electoral upside to this. It's the Republicans who are making an electoral gamble, and it's really weird because apparently they think that they can that getting out that Trump vote and getting that their boy Kavanaugh on the court immediately is a real electoral winner, and I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I want to harp on this and cover terrain that I've already covered, but, you know, I interviewed Ryan Grimm and was, you know, just fishing around because in the back of my head I'm like, what? It seems to me electorally, the way, you know, there was a poll, and I've mentioned this on the show earlier in the week. There was a poll that was it was an internal Republican poll. Now, you know, every time you read anything that is supposedly an internal poll, you got to ask yourself, well, if it's an internal poll, why do I know about it?
Why am I reading it?
Right. You know, I mean, I'm looking at Bloomberg Business Week right now, and it says a private survey shows, and I'm like, well, it's obviously not private. Somebody wanted me to know about it, and I'm not sure exactly why, but. And not me, obviously. I'm talking all of us. But it said that Republican voters are not engaged in this midterm election, in part because Donald Trump has said there's probably going to be a blue wave. So they don't think the stakes are very, I mean, a red wave. So they're believing him, and they don't think that they need to come out. And they also don't feel like there's any stakes to this. And there are stakes to this because not only, you know, we talk about impeachment and we talk about maybe the idea that even if the Democrats win the Senate, that the Republicans will put that fifth guy on. Clarence Thomas is 70, and there's been a lot of talk over the past couple of years. This is a guy who's not super excited to be on the court anymore. I think there's a, you know, if you look at the way that Ginny Thomas conducts her business, there seems to be a real desire to make some money in that household. And, you know, I suspect that if the Republicans retain the Senate, Clarence Thomas is going to announce his retirement, you know, at the end of this term, if he waits that long. It's not inconceivable to me that he wouldn't announce it sometime in April or, you know, March, and they start to look for somebody, and then we have these hearings again next summer. If the Senate, if the Democrats take the Senate, then it's a much different story, right? He's going to hold on for a couple of years and wait and see if Trump gets reelected. And so there's some stakes here because he's the, you know, that fifth vote. I mean, you know, Anthony Kennedy was a swing on some things, but not all things. But in the interim, we'll probably see the loss of abortion rights, if not overturning Roe v. Wade, certainly a loss of abortion rights over the next 2 years. People should understand that there are, every time you see one of these pieces of legislation passed by, I don't know, by, you know, Indiana or Alabama or, you know, Tennessee or Mississippi or something like this that are clearly unconstitutional in terms of abridging a woman's right to an abortion, understand these are, people are attempting to get these things brought to the Supreme Court, and they're just waiting for a court that's amenable to them. And so this is, you know, there's a lot of wheels in motion below the surface.
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know, look, even if they were to go a whole hog and overturn Roe versus Wade, they could go all the way, of course, and decide that, you know, that it's constitutional to completely ban abortion nationally. But far more likely is they're going to do what they've always said they were going to do, which is to send it back to the states, right? You know, they'll make the decision about which women have a right to, you know, control their own bodies. And all those things that are in the states, right, all those laws that are in the states would suddenly become law. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them, states that already have, you know, abortion bans on the on their, you know, on the books that would become law if right. the constitutional right is overturned. So, and look, I don't think anybody should fool themselves. They are, this is going to happen. I mean, this court with Kavanaugh as the fifth vote, I mean, Anthony Kennedy was holding on just with chewing gum and, you know, baling wire onto a you know, a right to abortion with Kavanaugh on the court. And probably anybody who replaces him, by the way, that Donald Trump nominates, this is going to happen. Roe versus Wade, you know, we've said for many years that this was coming, and it's here. If they, you know, if they get this fifth seat filled with a Donald Trump right-wing, you know, Federalist Society judge, no matter what he's saying right now. And by the way, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski know this very well. So do anybody else that, you know, considers themselves pro-choice in the Republican Party. They know what they're getting. And the fact that Kavanaugh hasn't come out and said it outright means nothing. They know very well that he is going to make that vote, as will any other nominee that they bring up. Donald Trump promised it on the campaign trail. Whoever I put in will be pro-life and will vote to ban Roe versus Wade. That's just the reality of this situation. It's terrifying. You know, it's one of the many terrifying things about Donald Trump winning the election. But here we are, and I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that that is a battle that is not going to be ongoing for a very long time. Now, whether they do it all at once or they do it piecemeal, I mean, I suspect they'll do it piecemeal because actually support for abortion rights is the majority in the country. They would be going very much against what most people, you know, believe right. about that subject.
Well, I mean,
but they're going to do.
Yeah, they'll do it. I mean, it'll be all of a sudden trap laws are okay. You know, it'll be a question of giving the states the less scrutiny on laws they pass that abridge the right in some way. All right. Well, let me just ask you this, because I don't know if, you know, there's been a lot of footage of the Anita Hill hearings that have been played for obvious reasons. I remember these hearings quite well. It actually, I started taking pictures of my television at that time and making refrigerator magnets. That's just a little bit of a little quirk people can know about me. But and back when I was starting sketch comedy with Cross Comedy in Boston, we did, I remember, a 45-minute sketch of these hearings, because it was incredible to watch a panel of men and, you know, sternly, there was, you know, I don't think I was aware of the term at the time, and there was no notion that Anita Hill was doing anything other than expressing how she had been victimized, but there was like a quality of slut shaming. Like there was a quality from these guys, like, how dare you make us say things like Long Dong Silver or whatever that guy's name was. And we're going to make you say the words pubic hair on a Coke can. And, it seems to me there is a lot of reason for these guys to be concerned about questioning Dr. Ford in public. And we should remind people that on the Republican side, still no women on that committee. And it's going to be a little bit awkward, I think.
Well, I think it is, too. Now, there's some talk, and maybe this will have been resolved by the time the show is on, but there's some talk about not having the senators do the questioning, to either have counsel for the two people, Kavanaugh and Ford, which I think is really weird, or have staff, legal staff on the committee do the questioning, or maybe just pick a couple of senators who are at least offensive, maybe have Ben Sasse, you know, the cute young guy, do it rather than Orrin Hatch, who, by the way, was the guy who said Long Dong Silver in the original Anita Hill hearings. Right. He's the one who did it. I'm sure he's longing to do something like that again. And maybe on the Democratic side, you could have, you know, people like, you know, Kamala Harris, who is a skilled prosecutor, someone who could do the questioning on the Democratic side. We'll have to see how that works out. But what you say about the Anita Hill hearing is absolutely true. The slut-shaming that went on there was absolutely horrifying. I remember Alan Simpson. He was from Wyoming. I don't know if people remember. He turned up a couple of years ago. With the Erskine Bowles. Simpson Bowles Commission. Well, he was one of those folksy guys, kind of like John Kennedy is today, or Lindsey Graham, who, you know, liked to, you know, sort of talk like he was, you know, somebody from the 18th century.
Right.
Anyway, he came in. I remember him saying, "Boy, you know, I've got things coming over the transom about this lady. You don't even want to know what these people are saying about her." He says this in the hearing. I remember watching it. I was riveted. In fact, I stayed home from work to watch the whole thing. And, I mean, it was grotesque, the slut-shaming. Now, I don't think that will happen this time. What appears to be their strategy, and this is kind of flowing all through the sort of right-wing fever swamps and in you know, certain circles, even in the Washington Post today by Kathleen Parker, suggesting that this woman is too addled to know who it was who attacked her that night, that it's mistaken identity. It's a little lady. She's got good intentions, but she's a little bit crazy. And so what this goes to, there's David Brock, actually, who was one of the original sort of strategist in the Anita Hill situation, and then wrote the book The Real Anita Hill, which he later apologized for in 2000.
Wait, I want to be clear on this, because I don't think a lot of people realize this. David Brock was one of the strategists on the right. He was one of the people should understand this, that David Brock got his start in politics by being one of the primary architects of the attacks on the Clintons. Back in the day. I mean, it had this, I don't know if people remember that in the way that you and I probably remember that. And so, continue. He said,
he wrote the book called The Real Anita Hill, which was this you know, total just smear job on the woman. It was after the hearings, but it was a way of trying to rehabilitate Clarence Thomas after he was confirmed. And David Brock apologized for it in 2000, so it's not like it was something, you know, he's had a, you know, a full change of heart and ideology and is now, you know, on the other side and has been for, you know, well over a decade. But in any case, the term that they coined for it was a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. Mm. Now, in the Me Too era, saying slutty probably isn't going to work because, you know, I think that having these guys or even an attorney or another woman on the, you know, some woman staffer, they don't have any women senators, so they'd have to get a staffer.
If this woman was
promiscuous, well, that would be a problem. I think they're going with nutty. I think that they're going to go with nutty, that she's a little bit strange, that she's got little memory problems, that she's not really reliable, that she's a little flighty, maybe a little hysterical, doesn't really remember what happened. Come on, honey. You know,
right.
It
could even be like, and I will say this, if they don't have senators do the questioning, I would be willing to bet everything I've ever owned or ever will own that they find a woman to do the questioning on the Republican side. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. But it's going to end up being you were 15, you were terrified. It must have been a horrible situation to be in. It is completely.
How many drinks did you have? Were you drinking that night?
I think it could be. Maybe you were drinking. You're at a party. I think it's going to be like everyone can completely understand that you wouldn't know who these people were. And and that's probably going to be their attempt. Now, I don't know how many times they can say that and how many times she can go, well, I knew who it was. You know, I knew this kid and I followed this guy's career. I didn't make it up 20 years later, but we'll see. I mean, it's going to be.
Well, it occurs to me that there's something interesting here that I just thought of, which is that this woman is a psychologist.
Right.
She's not just another woman. So it's possible that she can even bring her professional knowledge to bear there and say, well, look, you know, studies have shown that women, and this is true, too, by the way, that people who have a traumatic experience like that, their memory is actually pretty sharp of things like the identity of the person who perpetrated it. It's not common for them to be mixed up about that. I mean, maybe her professional credentials could actually work. I mean, in a normal situation, you'd have other people testify to that, right?
You'd
bring in some specialists and experts and all that. And by the way, you would certainly bring up the other guy she accuses of assaulting her in the room that night, this pig, that is the friend of Kavanaugh's, who's written, reams about what a drunken frat house atmosphere that school was and how they were all drunk and throwing up and God knows what else. And there's a lot of cruelty and hostility to women in the stuff that he's written as well. They would bring him up, too. But he's refusing, and I guess that's okay. You know, she can't refuse, but, you know, Mark Judge, that's the guy's name, he can refuse. But in a normal situation, you would have other witnesses that you would bring on to sort of go through the, you know, whether or not it's reasonable to believe that she knows what she's talking about under these circumstances. But, of course, they've decided that it's just going to be the two of them. So maybe she's going to have to be her own psychologist expert in that situation.
All right. Everything is, beyond what we've talked about is conjecture. The only other thing that's extant, and I haven't heard anything of it, was the reporting that Ryan Grimm had another story about the lawyer who first blew the whistle on Judge Kaczynski out in California, who at the time, everybody thought this lawyer was a lunatic. And ultimately was vindicated because Judge Kaczynski turns out to have been a grade A level sexual assaulter creep, And we had this, there was a hint of this yesterday or I guess today, Thursday, the story of Amy Chua, I guess it is, and her husband who were coaching a particular woman who was looking for a clerkship, and there were some like overtones, allusions to like he likes a certain look, he wants a woman who is outgoing, and this woman had said she had heard stuff about Kaczynski and stayed away. She had heard from Kavanaugh that there was some stuff, but not so much to dissuade her. And so, you know, I think there's probably a concern that there's somebody out there who says, I know Brett Kavanaugh knew about Kaczynski because I blankety blank blank. Now, for someone to come forward in that circumstance, they are obviously going to be in the legal profession, right? They are probably in the federal judiciary. They may have to go in front of a colleague of Kavanaugh's professionally.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a very risky proposition. And those people may be sitting back going like, making a calculation like, I don't want to do this if I'm not going to, if he's going to end up on the court, because then I'll have done this to a Supreme Court justice, as opposed to a guy who's not a Supreme Court justice and, you know, who the senators rejected. So it's unclear if we're going to hear from those two federal judiciary employees that this lawyer supposedly represents. So that is extant. We may hear things over the weekend. We may see some compelling appearances on television. You know, part of the reason why they're negotiating is probably to get her not to appear on television before she testifies. And, you know, her team will make that assessment if it's worth it or not. Because I'm not convinced that her going on television, her going on 60 Minutes, her going on the Sunday talk shows, whatever it is, won't have the same sort of damaging effect. Like, you know, go ahead, vote for him. I just gave my testimony to the American public. Brett Kavanaugh hasn't a chance to respond. And that's because you guys insisted on having this on Monday. I mean, the next couple of days are going to be fascinating in that regard. And we should just say before we go that one of the things that Donald Trump likes about Brett Kavanaugh is his perspective on presidential powers,
yep,
and whether or not he could be subpoenaed. And at the beginning of the week, it may seem like a year ago, Paul Manafort's plea deal cooperation agreement was, you know, basically made public, more or less. And this guy is wrapped up. There's no wiggle room. You know, they can fire Kavanaugh. I mean, they can fire Mueller. But Manafort, there's all the stuff is lined up, ducks in a row to get him, you know, to have him liable in at least one or two states, it seems to me, by a state AG. And, you know, Tish James in New York State, I'm sure the first thing she would love to do is to make sure that Donald Trump doesn't get away with firing Mueller by, you know, bringing up charges on Manafort. That story is like sort of weirdly hovering in the background. Like, I feel like any other week we would be talking nothing but that.
Oh, we would. I mean, it was huge, actually. And the right has this whole alternate narrative that they're on, that they're trying to push so they can give Trump some kind of justification for ending the investigation after the midterms, which Lindsey Graham and Grassley have both sort of indicated, winked and nodded anyway, that it's fine with them if Trump does it after the midterms. And, you know, just before we got on the phone, it was reported that Michael Cohen has spent over a dozen hours with Robert Mueller now. And I don't think Mueller's wasting his time with this guy. And there's no agreement, no cooperation, no plea, you know, nothing. I think it's just purely this is voluntary and they're talking to him. You know, I think Trump is in a panic, and that certainly is the reporting that he's in a panic. He released this classified information on the Carter Page stuff and this whole crazy conspiracy story this week. He released classified information, which he hasn't even read, purely on the basis of what, you know, the people he trusts, who he names as Lou Dobbs and Sean Hannity in the interview he gave to The Hill this week. I mean, this is becoming, and in fact, having Kavanaugh on the court, and perhaps this is why, really, when you get right down to it, they are so adamant that it be him and not one of the dozens of replacements they could easily
right.
put in. is because Kavanaugh is a guy who has pledged his loyalty, and he's a good party man, and he's a good, you know, conservative movement operative and a character assassination, and he has probably let everybody in the place know that he will back whatever the president's play is if any of these cases make it to the Supreme Court, and he will do it under the auspices of, you know, presidential power, which he has, you know, he can, there is a, you know, a judicial basis or a legal philosophical basis for doing this, and he's probably a guy that, you know, Trump now has sort of assumed is his best chance.
Before we wrap up, I want to just put a finer point on that, all right, so that people can just, to get a sense of this. People forget this. Neil Gorsuch, there was a moment where he said, and maybe he just said it to a senator, but maybe he said it somewhat publicly.
Blumenthal. He said Blumenthal.
Yeah, it was Blumenthal, where he said, like, yeah, no, I think it's inappropriate to go after judges because of their ancestry, something to that effect, right? And which showed a certain amount of, you know, at least some measure of willing to not completely toe the line. Brett Kavanaugh got up in front of everyone in the first statement he ever made as a nominee to the court and said, Donald Trump, like one that would have almost sound like just bizarre to even say about any president. He spoke to more people about this nomination than has ever been in the history of presidents or something to that effect. Something so ostentatious that it was so clearly a suck up to Donald Trump. It was almost like Donald Trump wrote it and gave it to him. I mean, that's the way that the diction sounded. And this is the same.
Like the doctor report that,
yeah,
that his doctor put out.
Honestly,
it was like that.
Exactly. And so, you know, just to get a sense of like where this guy's integrity is, this is the same guy who made that face, Kasowitz, when he was talking about his best friend's law firm, his best friend who had been there for 9 years. That is like grade A. You know, this is the type of stuff like you warn people about, right? Like, I wouldn't get too friendly with this dude, or certainly, you know.
Right.
I mean, that type of stuff is. So just to, you know, if it's not enough to like talk about what he did to Monica Lewinsky, forcing her to say, you know, count how many times that, you know, anybody, never mind the president, but anybody ejaculated, you know, in their mouth, that type. I mean, this guy went through. People should go back and read the questions that he asked Monica Lewinsky. He was also considered the designated leaker. That reports in the national memo. Don't know why that didn't get as much attention. This guy is a despicable character, and it's quite possible. It's, you know, for a lot of people, it would be sort of, I feel like, you know, a little bit hyperbole that they went in there and said loyalty pledge to the president. This guy, I wouldn't put it past him for a moment. And so it could very well be that Donald Trump has made it clear it's this guy I want. And if you don't get me this guy, you know, I'm going to go rogue in terms of the midterms. I mean, who knows? Right. I mean, because we've got to know that Donald Trump cares about his, future, not in prison, or his kid's future, not in prison, far more than any type of, you know, conservative legal worldview.
Oh God, he doesn't even know what a legal worldview is. No, this is all about self-preservation for him. And, you know, and he has sort of this grandiose idea that he's, you know, shaping the country for the next 50 years, which is true, but not, you know, because anybody's doing it because of him. This is purely a conservative movement accomplishment, is getting these people on the courts and packing the lower courts as well. I mean, it's not just the Supreme Court. I mean, McConnell is just, you know, he is ramming them through one after another. And that is Trump's legacy, but he can't really take credit for it since he doesn't even know.
And
what
it doesn't mean anything
to
him. It doesn't mean anything.
No, it's not nothing to him. But the idea that he is has obtained loyalty from this guy, I really believe you're right. And I don't think Kavanaugh would hesitate. This guy is a Republican operative. He's not, as Brian Schatz said on Pod Save America, he said, you know, he's not like Justice Gorsuch. He's not like Justice Roberts. He's not even a justice. He's a Republican activist, a Republican operative posing as a judge. And that is exactly what he is. And it's the perfect person for Trump, right? Yep. I mean, this is the guy that will do whatever it takes, that could easily be the one that they could bring in and say, hey, Brett, babe, you know, just tell this guy, give him, you know, get down on your knee, kiss his ring, tell him you're there for him. And, you know, that is what he needs to know. And I have no doubt that one way or the other, whether it was that overt or a little bit subtler, it can't be too subtle or Trump wouldn't understand it, but, you know, something to indicate that this guy was there for him and that he would hold the line on anything that came before them, because Donald Trump is all about self-preservation. You know, Tim O'Brien, the journalist who also was sued by Donald Trump years ago, and won his case. He says there's only two modes. Trump doesn't have a strategy. He has two modes. One is self-aggrandizement, and the other is self-preservation. That's it. That's right. All he is. And I think that that's true. And in this case, what he's looking at right now is self-preservation in big time, especially after that Manafort plea. Yep. And, you know, that locomotive, that Mueller locomotive is bearing down hard, and he's probably desperate to make sure that he's got as many backstops around him as he can to try and preserve, you know, his actual future, much less his presidency.
Heather Parton, Digby, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Self-preservation or self-aggrandizement? The two poles of excellence. Digby finally has a song.
She does, and if you just give me a moment, I'll look up who sent that in.
Yeah.
This was Don. Wait, does he have a name that he goes by?
Don.
And I have...
He's just a guy named Don.
Well, no, he says he has more stuff on Amazon. Hot Cologne and Precarious Neutron.
Hot Cologne and Precarious Neutron.
I believe that's it. I hope that's it.
Sounds good. All right. We are going to take a brief break, and we're going to return with a MB Friday regular, Corey Pine. Back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Corey Pine. He's the author of Live, Work, 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 Die. Corey. And of course, also the host of the Great News From Nowhere podcast, which people should subscribe to on Patreon if they haven't already. I do that too. Knowledgeable minds do that.
Thanks for the plugs right off the bat. I'm always happy to come on Majority Report and the Michael Brooks Show. I've yet to be invited on Literary Hangover. Mm. I might have been invited to Antifada, but it didn't work out.
You are welcome anytime, Corey. But we haven't totally figured out our setup for phone interviews yet, so we might have to do some work on that. Or next time you're in New York.
I don't know when that will be. I do have some good news about the book. I recently signed. Is this too self-promotional?
No, go for it. You ready for this? Hold on.
I recently signed what is known.
Go ahead.
That was awesome.
Yes, sir.
I'm pumped. I'm pumped now.
You should be pumped.
Elevated my mood. I recently signed what is apparently known as a shopping agreement. So there is hopes to develop Live, Work, Work, Die into some kind of televisual series. So if any of if any of your audience has ideas about people who are directors or producers or other sorts of talent.
I have ideas as to people who could be on both, I guess, acting and writing staff.
Yeah, I think I need to be on the writing staff.
Yeah.
Same. You should call it Silicon Valley.
Part two.
That's a great idea. I'm sorry, my kitten has a Gatorade bottle that's making a lot of noise.
I was wondering what that was. I was wondering. So, you know, Corey, I'm writing a book now, and I'm not trying to flog it too much, although it is starting to, the timeline is starting to accelerate and dilate on that a little bit more. And I don't consider, I mean, you know, I can write. I've published in certain places. I'm not a writer the way you are. But I remember talking with you, and without giving away any trade secrets, there was a big process that you had to go through with this book. And of course, you had a, you know, good big publisher and everything. And the lawyers take a look at everything before something gets published.
Yes, they do.
They take a good, good thorough look. And, you know, I'm writing a book that really actually, ironically, and it's funny that I have to say ironically in today's world, but it, you know, it deals with this. It's not just that, it's not just a critique of the intellectual dark web. It's actually an attempt to understand the moment we're in and why it would facilitate something like the intellectual dark web. And of course, it's going to involve critiques of these people. It's not going to involve any, like, of course, you know, made up stories or anything. It's going to involve dealing with their ideas. I'm sure, I have no doubt that, you know, Sam Harris will say he was taken out of context, but that's, you know, that seems to be like some type of gestalt response that he has to just basically anything that's even mildly critical. So he'll do his thing. But there's an interesting trend here with Jordan Peterson, because Jordan Peterson got on the map through sort of basically saying that I'm not going to, I'm not going to respond to people's gender pronouns, at least in a compulsory manner. And I'm willing to go to jail over this. He had this whole kind of public melodrama about this Canadian directive that he was responding to and definitely radically overreacting to. And he also was saying that, you know, speech codes of any kind sort of close the infrastructure of free speech. They limit the cognitive and linguistic territory. And what's been interesting in the last couple of months is that Jordan Peterson seems to have no problem limiting certain kinds of cognitive and linguistic territory, and those involve anybody who's critical of him. He called several months ago, he sued a university in Canada, basically professors who had criticized him. He sued them for a conversation that they had in a leaked tape where, I mean, the professors did not come off well in the tape at all, but it's a bit of an incredibly astonishing thing to sue over, especially for a self-proclaimed free speech advocate. And now Jordan Peterson has sent a letter to an author by the name of, scrolling it down for me. Is it in the
I've got it
graph?
Here. Yeah. Kate Mann.
Kate Mann. Yes, Kate Mann.
She's a professor at the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell. Hmm. So she's a...
I'm defenseless against that kind of female insanity.
So basically, and you might ask yourself, like, did she... As I said, like, did she make up a story about him? Did she say that he killed somebody? Did she do something like that? No, she called him a misogynist in Vox. And
not
which,
even,
yeah.
I mean,
not even that. I explain what she did. Yeah, go ahead.
I actually have. So I learned about this story. He filed this, or his lawyer did, back in June, but I just learned about it, I think, with most people this week with an article in The Cut.
Right.
By Aaron Carman. Right. And they got a hold of the letter that Peterson's lawyers sent. And the first, it's very short, so I'll just read some of it, if you don't mind. I think
it's pretty
entertaining to get the source material.
Can you do it
here.
In the voice?
It addresses not just
I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Voice.
Go no. Do All it. Do
this
it.
Would be
give
the
it
Peterson's
a read.
Lawyer voice.
All right.
Okay. So it's addressed to Professor Kate Mann at Cornell, to Professor Derek Paraboom, the chair of her department at Cornell.
Wow.
Sean Ealing, the Vox reporter who interviewed Kate Mann, and Vox Media.
I know Sean Ealing. Sean Ealing, good guy, Majority Report listeners. Love him.
And it's fun.
Fake
and
news.
And it's, which is just, it's okay, first of all, it's just really unusual that I can understand including Vox on there if you're going to be pursuing a libel or slander claim, but adding the chair of her department is just a bullying tactic.
Oh, yeah.
Total scab move.
Yeah. Okay. So then it's this letter serves as notice of action, blah, blah, blah. On June 6th, the following libelous statements by Professor Mann were published on the website below. And then it lists some quotes from the professor that upset Jordan Peterson. And they are, I also think the way Peterson cherry-picked a few more dignified sounding sentences from the diary of one of the Columbine killers, Eric Harris, was downright dishonest. I suspect that for many of Peterson's readers, the sexism on display is one tool among many to make forceful domineering moves that are typical of misogyny. So she didn't actually call him a misogynist. Mm. She just said it was like misogyny.
Lawsuit.
Then, oh,
like then you're sued.
Then she does go on to frame one of his quotes as classic straight up misogyny. And then Peterson measures himself by the size of his celebrity, the idea of winning
it's
or dominating others.
Sorry.
As an end to itself, eyebrow raising, authoritarian sounding. And she, the last statement they include, it doesn't seem accidental that his skepticism about objective facts arises when it's conveniently anti-feminist. And then there's lawyers from Levitt LLP demand, please.
Jew lawyers, it's IQ science.
Please immediately retract all of Professor Mann's defamatory statements, have them immediately removed from the internet, and issue an apology in the same forum to Mr. Peterson. Otherwise, our client will take all steps necessary to protect his professional reputation, including but not limited to initiating legal proceedings against all of you for damages, including punitive damages.
Oh, man. How do we not have the Jerky Boys sound drop for that?
Sue everybody.
Oh, and he says,
and the people you associate with, I'll be suing them as well.
Cornell University is vicariously liable for Professor Mann's defamatory statements. Now,
what does that mean?
Well, as the Supreme Court of Canada has made clear, liability can be imputed to employers due to damages caused by their employees and or officers.
Yeah, they're platforming the hussy.
Yeah, they're platforming her.
So. Yeah. This really just gives up the ghost. I mean, the idea that you can stand up as a free speech warrior and then have your personal attorney send around these kind of bullying letters to get articles removed from the internet and replaced with fawning apologies is like as far from free speech as you can get. And this stuff does have an effect on media organizations. I mean, in the article that interviewed Sean Ealing, basically he says that his employers and their lawyers laughed it off because it was a joke. I mean, there's nothing actionable in the U.S. or Canada about what the woman said.
Right. I mean, this is, there's literally nothing. This is if this was the standard, basically, you couldn't write a critical book review. You couldn't do anything.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Exactly. It's a newer, establishing new linguistic territory where you can't criticize my books.
He wants to sue about the stuff that free speech is for.
Yeah, well, I think that's the kind
and I also,
of... Right.
I also suspect that the fact that she's at Cornell and he's stuck up in the frozen north is part of it, too, because here's somebody from a arguably more prestigious university who's knocking him and is from... He's in the philosophy department, too, if I recall,
no, he's
right?
No, psychology. I mean, this is psychology.
He's psychology, yeah.
Psychology. But I think your broader point that... that he's lower than her in the dominance hierarchy and should keep his mouth shut stands.
And a woman at that.
Yeah. Yeah, but a woman who's at a better college, so it's a tough road.
Who
there.
Knows? That's chaos.
That's chaos. Chaos at Cornell, lawsuit edition. No, but I think what you're saying, it's like, yes, it's not just like the obvious giving up of the ghost here in terms of like, you know, this guy and this whole silly movement is constantly banging on about free speech. And now, like, this is one of the only maneuvers available where one can really shut down free speech, right? Like, this isn't, oh, no, I was criticized for saying something. That's against my free speech. This is, like, actually, literally, you're making an analysis of my work that I don't like. I'll sue you. Ouch. So I think... You know, that's one part of it. And it does give up the ghost, but it also really shows that, like, not only is it giving up the ghost, but I think I don't think this is a good thing, because I am probably more on the, like, you know, and certainly when it comes to legal and policy decisions, I'm pretty strong on, you know, free speech protections. I don't think that there's an advantage for the left in any type of a long-term way for sort of like speech limitation, right? And I also don't think that speech limitation is necessarily how you win the war against the people that, you know, forward fascistic or any other types of, disgusting ideas, right? But it's just striking now that, like, I guess that these people like Jordan Peterson are not only are they giving up the ghost, they've turned... the idea of free speech that actually has some, at the very least, agree or disagree, an incredibly important intellectual history and has served a really important role in our society and also in some very left movements, into just like a punch, like, oh, that guy's talking about free speech. There's a fascist, right? Like,
yeah.
They have totally toxified the brand of actually a very... you know, admirable.
Well, isn't that what
tradition.
Fascists would want to do?
Yes.
Free speech. I mean,
yes.
As an actual concept.
Exactly.
Versus,
exactly. Well, there's the, you know, we've played Richard Spencer, you know, 9 months ago or so, saying like, well, of course we don't actually support free speech, but it's a weapon in our arsenal. And I'm not saying, before people freak out, I don't think Jordan Peterson and Richard Spencer are the same characters, but it's like, obviously there's similar water that they're in, intentionally or unintentionally. And this reveals it. You can't, you know, banging on about basically like, I will go to the mat to make sure that I don't respect, you know, identity categories of students, but you can't criticize my book in Vox? What?
You know, there's another similarity that I immediately thought of when I saw this story, because the last Nazi rally that I went to, I might have mentioned it on this I think I just told friends about this. I don't think I even mentioned it on my show. But there was this guy that was there, mm-hmm. young guy, sort of like typical college age, alt-right, Pepe kind of troll. And I recognized him from several of these previous rallies. But at this one, he was presenting himself as a sort of young, progressive criminal justice reform advocate, and pressing his line on anybody who would listen, including all the national press that was there to cover this thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came up and talked to me, and I was like, yeah, that's fine. I'll hear you out. I'll hear your spiel as long as I can record it.
Right.
So I was recording him visibly, you know. And, you know, at the end of his spiel, his first example for criminal justice reform was the Bundys and how maltreated they were. And I'm like, okay, I see what's happening here.
It's an interesting starting point.
you know, when he at the end of it, he's like, okay, what do you think about what I said, like, man to man And I was like, man to man, are you kidding with me? Like, he's like, no, really, man to man. Like, how are you going to spin this? And I'm like, okay, well.
You're going to go on the Majority Report and make fun of me with Michael? Man to man.
The guy's always laughing in the background.
I said,
you know,
okay, man.
I find this Nation of Islam Obama a little problematic.
Yeah, super problematic impression. Man to man.
Okay, man. I've seen you at these right-wing rallies for more than a year, and I'm really surprised to see you presenting yourself as a young progressive up-and-comer. It's really not what I would have expected. So, you know, I think you're bullshitting me with this whole thing.
Right.
And he's like, immediately goes to, I'll sue you. I'll get you fired. Who do you work for again? I'm totally getting you fired. I've been recording all of this.
Wow.
You're fucked, basically. And,
totally fucked.
You know, that is right out of the playbook. I mean, they're picking up this strategy somewhere. I'm not saying that Jordan Peterson is telling all of his weird, you know, minions to follow the strategy of suing people who don't portray them as they wish to be portrayed at any given moment. But clearly it's out there,
right?
You know, in the waters that they swim in. And, you know, it's kind of a tell, right? Like, their idea of free speech is you say what we want said or else.
Right.
Because, you know, this example with the kid that I just gave, I mean, I know he was an alt-right activist. I knew his purpose was to, you know, essentially try to recruit people with sort of deceptive tactics into his movement by misrepresenting himself.
Right.
And
right.
The idea, his idea of what a good interview would have been, and I don't know if any other reporters who were there bit on this, but I know it happens all the time. These people use fake names and they come up with different, you know, PR strategies ahead of their events, hoping to get national press. You know, his idea of a good interview would be I passed on a pack of lies from him.
Right.
And that's simply not what free speech is. Was for free speech is for so we can have honest discussions, you know, and advance, you know, an understanding based on factual information.
Right.
So the thread that you see with these, you know, Nazis using their legal threats and Jordan Peterson using his to protect his professional reputation, whatever that is that it's. It does go back to this sort of like patriarchal dominant idea of what I say is free speech. What you say is slander, unless you're echoing what I say. And that,
right.
That's simply not free speech. That is totalitarian propaganda.
Right.
Well, I think right. That speaks to what Mariana said the other day, which is fascists have very slippery tactics and they're very adaptable to whatever is popular at the moment. Like
right.
Barry Weiss likes to call herself a liberal, and that's a neat rhetorical trick. Because also, like, in addition to wanting their ideas spread, they want to be liked and respected. And, you know, it's like the same thing as Peter Thiel, who sued Gawker out of existence because they clowned on him constantly. Granted, they gave him a reason when they outed him, so it would look a little better on his end. But
if
like
the Saudis knew, I wouldn't get money.
Like they don't want to just be able to talk. They want to be in mainstream platforms, and they want to be liked and respected. And they can't handle it when people speak against them.
Yeah, you know, I think actually Nick Denton, the former Gawker owner, is pretty convincing when he talks about how the outing wasn't really an outing. Especially in his peer group, Thiel's peer group, and that the real motivations for the lawsuit probably had more to do with their coverage of the businesses that he funded.
Oh, yeah.
That was negative.
He is a cold-blooded killer. I promise you he doesn't care at all about, like, you know, socialized homophobia or
and
whatever.
Just in context of the conversation, he's figuratively speaking. a cold-eyed killer?
As far as we know,
figurative,
yes.
As far as we know. I mean, there's a lot of legitimate questions to ask there.
Cold blood. I mean, that's also a thing I like.
Yeah. Blood is an interest.
Ice cold refrigerated blood.
Ice cold refrigerated blood.
Corey, did you see this Data and Society heat map of the Alternative Influence Network on YouTube?
Do you have it up?
Yeah, we'll put it up.
I did. I haven't had the chance to dig into it. A number of people sent it to me saying, look, it's everything you've said, which is nice to see, but it also doesn't put it at the top of my reading pile because it's like, well, I already know it. But what did you learn from it?
Well, to be honest, I'm only looking at it. It's funny to see how big of a hub Sargon of Akkad is.
He really has some staying power.
But also...
Although I think it's because he's getting connected with UKIP. He's actually like becoming a UKIP figure in the UK.
There's some names I haven't heard of. Like, I don't know who Andy Worski is.
I don't know who that is.
I've never heard that name before. But Stefan Molyneux is also the other one. So,
right.
I mean, what I find most interesting... Cut away for a little bit, Jamie. I got another thing to put up there. Is that Ben Shapiro, Rubin, and Crowder have been freaking out because they're on it, you know, listed very closely to people like Stefan Molyneux. So Ben Shapiro writes, so now we've got a voxing of the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon study that connects me with Richard Spencer. Well done, as always. Well done, as always.
Well done, as always. Yes. Doesn't this also, well, I mean, actually, Corey, tee off on that first, and there's something else I want to.
There's one more here.
Okay,
we got Dave Rubin. They all got mad because Ezra Klein tweeted it out. It's funny how Ezra.
Oh, Dave Rubin's still doing this?
Yeah, you want to read that one?
Hey, Dave. At Ezra Klein. Want to explain to me how a gay, married, pro-choice, pro-pot, against death penalty for reforming prison/drug sentencing is part of the reactionary right? You know what's so funny about this trope now is I actually think not that any of these, you know, fascists would go to the mat for these issues, but actually what's very funny to me is there are, in today's political environment, there's probably any number of highly reactionary, you know, anything to overt white supremacist people who actually probably come down on the so-called left side of all of these issues, right?
Right.
Like, drugs should be legalized. People are over-incarcerated.
Some of these are so easy just to say, right? Like, I'm against the death penalty.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, marriage equality and anti-death penalty and pro-pot are basically, like, and I would say even pro-choice amongst a certain subset. Like, those are not... The new dividing line with sort of like the right and left, I think, for like under 40 or under 35 or whatever is not like it's I mean, there's obviously still religious right wingers, but it's more like, well, yeah, I mean, I support gay marriage, but I think we should have a white ethno state, which is not included
or
in this dumb Dave Rubin
like
tweet.
None of those are terribly redistributionary either.
Of course,
he's ditched the healthcare stuff.
Right. This is just. I mean, that's the other way. It's just libertarian, whatever. And you know, and this is also another reason why it's very, very tricky to get into alliances with those people. But Corey, you were going to say in terms of this stat and how it's validated.
Oh, yeah. Well, I finally am looking at this heat map, and I don't recognize who some of these as well, like Kraut NT and Bunty King.
Yeah, I don't know most of these
computing
folks.
I mean, I don't want to advertise stuff that's probably just funneling people into some, you know, hellish sort of Nazi spiral. But many of these I do, and they're, you know... It's good to see people do this work, but it's sort of also like stuff that you can figure out just by watching these folks.
It's like following your own algorithms. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and the way that the other shows that they recommend, I mean, it just sort of it's confirmation of stuff that not just myself, but people, many guests on your show. The whole crew have been saying for, you know, a couple of years. And hopefully what this does, this kind of research, is convince the sort of mainstream press. And by that, I mean, you know, the press that feels it has to be neutral regarding the alt-right still, because they're still out there. That the people who are presenting themselves as classical liberals or just simply liberals, and yet echoing alt-right arguments, shouldn't be taken at face value.
Right.
That's been my main message to friends in the media who are working at those kind of outfits, because it can be hard. I mean, to tie it back to what we were talking about before, not everyone is fortunate enough. And, you know, I've made quite a bit of sport about Ezra Klein over the years, but not everybody is fortunate enough, like your buddy from Vox, to work for someone who will receive a legal threat like that and respond appropriately, by which I mean laugh it off and go back to doing your work. A lot right. of times right. those kind of threats do have chilling effects on speech.
Right.
And, you know, the people that need to be convinced that there are bad faith actors associated with the alt-right or with overlaps in terms of audience with the alt-right, who present themselves as something other than what they are.
Yeah.
And I hope these kind of investigations and sort of the quantified approach, where you actually get a nice, easily referenced infographic at the end, convinces people who don't yet get it. Although I think most of your listeners do.
Yeah, I think so. I also, yeah, go ahead.
Well, here's the thing. Nazis historically have used liberal values that they do not believe in a bad faith way to advance themselves within a liberal society. So maybe I struggle with this myself, but maybe there is a case for deplatforming the farthest of the far right, like actual neo-Nazis.
Yeah,
like our friend Brandon Jordan made a good documentary about the anti-fascist movement, kind of connecting it up through history. And like, when Hitler was rising to power, like Nazis had their rallies out in the open and drew tons of people and bolstered their cause that way. So the question then becomes, you know, obviously the people we're dealing with now in America are a bunch of, you know, LARPing edgelords, but at what point is it a good idea to intervene with them having a platform?
That's the question. I think there have been some misfires, but for the most part, you know, the Antifa deplatforming strategy seems to have worked. I mean, remember a few, couple of months ago when Richard Spencer was like, can't raise money anymore. And you've had Milo out there whining about how, right. you know, well, woe is Milo.
Yeah, if nothing else, it costs them tons and tons of money.
And that's the part plus, that I support.
Yeah, plus,
that's
why a lot of right. these rallies where they say, oh, our free speech is being suppressed, they're not just there to talk. They're there to beat up liberals and people of color and anti-fascist activists.
Well, that's the point I try to stress whenever I'm on a sort of mainstream show and they ask about these subjects, because it's what I've seen repeatedly, that, you know, these aren't free speech rallies. They're rallies designed to provoke or incite violence. And, you know, just because you call it a free speech rally and wave an American flag and co-opt all this symbolism and language and essentially appropriate the cultural context of American patriotism for you know, fascistic ends, it does seem to fool a number of people. So you do have to address them on the terms that they present, unfortunately, even if it's easier for some of us to see through than others.
Corey, and I also just, the only other thing I want, and we got to get to your movie pick in a second, and I guess we'll get to the trashing of Bloomberg at and all later. Maybe this is, at this moment, probably more important than a guy who's preparing to waste a huge amount of money on sort of warmed over ought campaign. I kind of hope he does it, frankly. But
can I say this about yeah. Michael Bloomberg? I tried yes. to look up in prep how many times he's announced a potential
interest, right?
president. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's one of those questions that there are so many results, it's impossible to Google it.
Right.
You
I'm
know,
thinking
so,
long and hard.
You probably have to go back to the 80s to find the time when Michael Bloomberg was not announcing his intention to run.
That sounds
president.
About right, actually.
It's a little, And nobody wants, I mean, what's really, it just shows you what money can get you. It can get you taken seriously by people who otherwise would have the sense to ignore you.
Right. What's this, Matt?
This is Bloomberg. Do you want to just talk about the I do her thing with Michael Bloomberg?
I just don't even. Oh, right. So I get. Yeah. Also, Bloomberg. And this actually came up when he first ran for mayor. There's like a litany of, you know, basically just, you know, gross comments at Bloomberg LLC, including, I think, one time he pointed at a pregnant woman and said, kill it. Is one of the allegations, one of the things that somebody said he said. And then also in another...
He also said great number 16 as a reference to all the women getting pregnant at his workplace.
And then the other woman he spoke to and he said, or spoke of, he said, I do her. So there's also just this other part. And, you know, again, we're a little tight on time, but it was really funny that, like, I mean, his big New York Times sort of, I might run for president, was essentially like, I will run as a Democrat and I'll defend stop and frisk and they're too mean to the bankers and Charlie Rose got a raw deal.
We have to point out though
welcome to 2020.
With regarding the I do her statement.
Yeah, what's the context for that?
He said so of some of the things about the comments about the woman's pregnancy, he says he left a voicemail saying, I didn't say it, but if I said it, I didn't mean it. And then the article goes on. This is in The Atlantic. What Bloomberg reportedly did concede is that he had said of Garrison and other women, I do her. In making the concession, however, he insisted that he believed that to do someone meant merely to, quote, have a personal relationship with them.
wow. Maybe it's like Michael Scott, and he was just trying to make these women feel better about themselves because they were getting fat.
No, I think there's some other quote. There's some other Bloomberg quotes that would undermine that theory.
I find that more offensive than, you know, the sort of vulgarity.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I have to say, it's
the
like,
idea
yeah,
that we're
right,
supposed to believe
right.
that is more offensive.
Yeah, that's the thing. I guess that's kind of what I was suggesting earlier. Like, to be honest, it's like, you know, I think, like, it would be dishonest if most men didn't acknowledge, like, yeah, I made a boorish comment. And if he said that and said, like, look, sorry. Learned, moving on, versus like some type of nonsense.
I do her,
ludicrous,
which means like
which
I
means
would
like
get
I'd
coffee
like,
with her a couple times
I'd
a month.
I'd like to have some tea, talk about her career prospects. I don't know why I'm still doing Jordan Peterson, but it's just ridiculous. It's like, it's nonsense. I mean, I don't understand. Like, just like have the room for humility.
Don't you think Bloomberg is really into Jordan Peterson? Though. I mean,
I think Jordan Peterson cries too much for Bloomberg. I think Bloomberg keeps it a little bit tighter.
I like how postmodern they all get, though, when confronted with some shit that they said that's pretty hard to mistake. Like,
they're pretty.
That depends on what your definition of is.
What does do mean? Said.
That was Bill Clinton's vintage look. Depends what your definition of is.
Also, one last thing I want to throw in about Bloomberg is, you know, his news company. Killed a major story about corruption in the Chinese government in order to protect the business expansion into China. And the reporters who were working on this story, this was a few years ago, wound up leaving the company and moving to the New York Times, which has forever colored Bloomberg in a negative light in the eyes of many journalists, and rightfully so. Oh, and it also calls into question how he runs his company. And if you don't think that Republicans would dig in to Bloomberg's sundry conflicts of interest that he would have coming into office and be all over that emoluments angle, since we all know what that means now, I think it's silly to think that they wouldn't. And moreover, they'd probably do a better job of it than the Democrats have when it comes to Trump, even though Trump's, you know, are evidently more corrupt.
Right.
So I'll just say that.
No, I think that's
bad
true.
Idea. Bad idea for 100,000 different reasons.
Bad idea. But you know what? If a couple of consultants want to get rich and we can definitively have somebody like this get crushed in a Democratic primary, I'm not opposed to it. And also, I want to say, too, I know some people have anxiety about him running as an independent. And I actually, the only thing that I will say positive about Mike Bloomberg is I I don't think he wants to be responsible for Donald Trump getting reelected. And I don't think, and I think that is why he's talking about doing this as a Democrat. And number two, he's not going to get any traction. This politics has no appeal to anybody who isn't on the Upper West Side, or not even that, forget it, potentially the Upper East Side, Westchester County, and a handful of other suburbs, maybe some of the suburbs of Philly. That could be tricky, but like, this is going to be the inverse of a grassroots campaign. There'll be all the consultants and money and brand positioning the world, but it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, but he was invited to speak at the DNC last time around.
That's their move. I mean, I think that move in and of itself, as part of like just a get under Trump's skin strategy, was not terrible. But, you know, obviously it reflected the broader just sort of weakness of Democratic message.
Do you not think the leadership of the Democratic Party would side with Bloomberg over a Bernie?
But I don't.
Would they be more subtle about it, maybe, and get like Kamala Harris or Cory Booker?
I definitely think they're at a point where, to the extent that that stuff matters, their move for a more centrist candidate from the establishment is absolutely going to be behind a Kamala Harris and a Cory Booker instead of a Michael Bloomberg. It isn't. He's not.
They want to let some steam out of the left.
Yeah,
with
that would be a disaster. I mean, what is the rationale for a like 70-something plutocrat who not only is not good on all of these things that are like increasingly important to Democratic voters, he has like stop and frisk, women's rights, like banks, he is overtly hostile on
guns, though.
I think guns can be matched in rhetorical jousts with a Cory Booker or a Kamala Harris. And there will be, however this shakes out, there will be an actual authentic option. Hopefully Bernie, but it could also be Elizabeth Warren. So I don't see it.
Well.
Corey, we've got a minute. What movie should we watch?
Okay, I actually have three recommendations. Oh, wow. Two are still in theaters. They might have come up on your show.
Okay.
They definitely deserve segments. Either on mine or Majority Report or something. Death of Stalin could still be out there.
Great movie.
Armando Iannucci.
So good.
Awesome. Sorry to Bother You. Also fantastic.
We've talked about this and did a whole segment on it on TMZ.
You did? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I missed it. I'll go back.
No, it's fine. Yeah, but it's definitely a good movie.
But my recommendation is something that came out in 2004, which I realize is ancient history. It means a lot of people probably haven't seen it, but there's this whole publicity campaign around Crazy Rich Asians as some kind of like groundbreaking representation thing. I want to recommend a movie that is not necessarily so classist in its representation of Asian characters. It's called Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
That's a fun movie. That's a fun movie.
I just rewatched it with my wife.
Does it hold up?
I think last week. Okay. Yes. Most of the humor holds up. There's some stuff that you go, oh, yeah, this wouldn't fly anymore. But for the most part, it's just, you know, a fantastic stoner movie. The treatment of the built-in product placement, also genius. Apart from serving as the plot device, it comes in at the very end in a way, in a line that is perfectly delivered by John Cho. And I'm gonna butcher the line. I believe it is, it must have been those delicious burgers. And because, you know, their whole, well, it's a spoiler, but,
no spoilers.
You know, at the end, everything works out all right. through a miraculous turn of events, and everybody gets what they want. And the line that I hadn't noticed in previous viewings has to do with the magic power of the burgers, which certainly made White Castle really happy. You know, but it's the je ne sais quoi with which it's delivered with this subtlest of smirks, even if you don't like the rest of the movie, it's, or you think it's stupid, stoner comedy, which it certainly is, you have to admire John Cho's delivery. I mean, I think it's a greatest of all time, sort of, like, here's looking at you, kid, kind of line.
Corey Pine, thanks as always, my man. Live, work, 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 die, Journey to the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley. Buy the book before it becomes a successful show that we all write and perform on. Become a patron of at News from Nowhere with Corey. Great podcast, very insightful. Corey, thanks as always, man.
Thanks a lot. It's fun.
All right. We are going to, it's going to be a little bit truncated. I can't go super long today, but we are going to get to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today. Majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. Become a patron of the Michael Brooks Show. Michael Brooks Show. All the content you can get there as a patron is broken down at patreon.com/TMBS. Do that. Jamie.
Yeah, so this week on the Antifada, we released our episode yesterday. We are joined by writer David Kleon to talk about what, if anything, the left can take from the whole Russia story. Mm-hmm. We drag on everyone's favorite Hasbro hack, Barry Weiss, including in song. We talk about the elections. We talk about David's own journey to the left. And Sean and I get a divorce twice, so...
Oh, wow.
Check it out. Also, we're probably going to unlock our History as a Weapon, number one, on historical materialism soon, because I think it's really good, and it's a good little sampling of what's available to you if you become a member at patreon.com/theantifada.
Matthew.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. We zoomed past 100 subs yesterday because people really want to hear me read this Hope Leslie. So
that's a good idea.
I actually read for 2.5 hours last night, which it's work to narrate a book. Like
oh
that.
Yeah,
like that is a.
I would imagine
my vocal cords are feeling good. They feel like, you know, when you haven't worked out for months and yep. then you really get after it. That's where I'm at today. But it went really well, and it's a. I'm really enjoying it. So I think I might do that every 50 patrons is do a new book. So smart. Yeah, patreon.com/literary hangover. Check that out. Also, we did the Scarlet Letter that released on Saturday. Check that out. It's a good episode. If you haven't checked it out yet, it's not just me and Alex this time. We have three people. And as we all know, when you add a third person to a podcast, the conversation, I think, loosens up quite a bit.
I think that that reflects the Griscom edition
right?
on TMBS.
To end, we have... Jimmy Reefer Cake and Adam Rainstopper. I think we're just going to play that.
Oh, okay, great. We'll play it out. Cool.
This is called Kavanaugh Piss Off.
How long is the song?
2 minutes and 45 seconds.
All right. I am going to go do something. No, not... And that sounded really bad. I'm not trying to diss. I just need
Yeah,
to,
don't diss these guys.
It's no diss. All right, let me... You know what? We'll do some La Poupée so I can hear some of it. I can't hear anything.
Kavanaugh wants you to lie.